Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to a very special edition of the Following On podcast. I'm John Norman, bringing you an archived edition of the brilliant My Sporting Life. In this episode, TalkSport's Danny Kelly sits down with the West Indies legend Michael Holding to discuss his remarkable career both on and off the pitch. And we will be releasing old editions of My Sporting Life every Friday here on Following On. Huge names like Curtly Ambrose, Clive Lloyd and Sir Richard Hadley all to come. So keep an eye out for those in the coming weeks. But for now, after he announced his retirement from the commentary box this week, let's bring you My Sporting Life with the great Michael Holding.
Taking centre stage on tonight's My Sporting Life is one of the most fearsome bowlers in Test match cricket history, the West Indies great Michael Holding.
He's out, LBW this time. There's a danger man, Holding.
Ernest Bowling played on. A very, very good Yorker, that one. I word, that's a good piece of bowling from Holding.
And it's Bowling. So Holding strikes again.
My Sporting Life on Talk Sport.
Over the course of the next 2 hours, we'll hear about being reduced to tears while playing for West Indies.
I went out to a perhaps extra cover somewhere around there and I knelt down and the tears came to my eyes. I think it was Lance Gibbs who ran over to me from
Bully. Bless him.
And said, Mikey, you have to continue. And
kicking the stumps while playing against New Zealand.
And he looks at the umpire and the umpire just shakes his head. So he just stood there and put the glove back on. And when I saw that, I just saw red. The mist came down, as they said.
And the impact the West Indian cricket team had on the Caribbean nations.
When the West Indies did it, oh, we are brutal. And that's spoiling the game. That's not cricket. Perhaps we were just up before our time.
On DAB Digital Radio and 1089 and 1053 AM. My Sporting Life on Talk Sport.
Yes, Michael Anthony Holding, born the 16th of February 1954 at Halfway Tree in Kingston, Jamaica. Michael's one of the greatest and most fearsome fast bowlers in the history of Test cricket, a reputation gained for his performances in the legendary West Indies side that dominated the sport throughout the 70s and 80s. In 60s tests for the West Indies, he took 249 wickets, including 14 for 149 against England at the Oval in the summer of 1976, finest match figures ever by a West Indian. He's also remembered for arguably the most ferocious over ever in Test cricket against Geoffrey Boycott at the Kensington Oval in 1981 when he smashed the English batsman's wicket with a six ball. While in the One Day International Arena, he took 142 wickets in 102 appearances and was a member of the West Indies side which won the World Cup in 1979. He also represented Jamaica, Lancashire, Tasmania, Derbyshire and Canterbury in first-class cricket, and after retiring from playing side of the game in 1989, he's forged a highly successful media career as a respected cricket commentator, as well as spending time as an ICC official. On TalkSport this evening, I'm joined by the cricket legend, the man nicknamed Whispering Death, my favourite bowler of all time, Michael Holding. You were born and grew up in the capital of Jamaica, Kingston. What kind of childhood did you have?
Well, I'd have to say, Danny, I had a very happy childhood in that I was allowed to play all sorts of sports. And, you know, as a young man, you're playing sports, you're outdoor most of the time, you're enjoying life. You know, we didn't have any restrictions as to what time of the day we could go out, especially during the summer holidays. You know, my parents were sports-loving people. My father played football, he played cricket. My mother did athletics, she played table tennis. I have three elder siblings, all of them played sports. So, you know, it was a sporting family and we were allowed to play sport and enjoy ourselves.
Many years ago, in a lifetime far, far away, I was a music journalist and I got to go to Kingston and to Jamaica several times. And back in those days, one could see Kingston particularly, it was both areas of great poverty and also some very beautiful tree-lined middle-class streets. Where was your family in all of that?
Well, my parents met in downtown Kingston at Kingston Parish Church. My father was an altar boy and my mother was in the choir at Kingston Parish Church. So they grew up downtown. Coronation Market, don't know if you heard Coronation Market. My father used to accompany his father to Coronation Market because he sold down there and he used to accompany him and help him with his goods that he was selling. My mother grew up on Luke Lane, again downtown Kingston. But by the time I came along, my parents were then living halfway through Dunrobin Avenue. So they had pretty much bettered themselves. Mm-hmm. They had moved out of downtown Kingston. They were living in Halfway Tree on Dunrobin Avenue. And of course, I was the fourth of the four kids. So by the time I came along, they had pretty much settled and they were a little bit more comfortable in life. Although I didn't get everything I wanted, I got what I needed. So I was never really in need.
Did you love school?
Yeah, I enjoyed school. As a matter of fact, when I left KC, which was the high school that I went to, I was sad. I enjoyed my school life. I spent a lot of time at KC and had a great time.
Did you do school work? So many sportsmen I speak to, they seem to have spent all their time just dreaming about playing cricket, football, whatever, rugby, whatever it is, and neglecting their studies.
I neglected my studies to a degree, yes. I enjoyed life too much at school. By the time I got to KC, I was 10 years old when I went to KC, and I had gotten a scholarship to go to KC. I had done well enough to get a scholarship to go to KC. So I was doing okay as a kid. And then when I got to KC, I got too involved. I was playing cricket, I was playing football, I was playing table tennis, I was playing basketball. The only thing I didn't play was play hockey and swim.
Yeah.
So I was getting involved in everything. So I really enjoyed that aspect of the school. I almost got myself into a bit of trouble at one stage as well, Dali, because my mother, who was a teacher, when I was about 14, 15 years old, she started teaching at KC.
Terrible, terrible news.
Yes, yes. But she wasn't on the same campus I was on. So, no, I left school one day to walk over to the campus where she was, and you weren't supposed to be doing that. And the headmaster caught me, but because he knew that I was Mrs. Holding's son, you know, I got away a little bit lightly. But I had a good time there.
I mean, looking at you now, you're still the tall, lean, muscular figure you were when you were playing professional cricket. And we now know, of course, Jamaica dominates running in the world of athletics, doesn't it?
Yes, yes. Sprints.
You'd have been around to watch Don Quarry being the great and wonderful sprinter he was. I mean, were you good at athletics in general?
Not really.
You like games, yeah?
I did athletics, yes, but I represented my house in the school because, you know, within the school you have these championships and the house things and you represent your house. I wasn't good enough to represent my school on the track.
Oh, really?
I represented the school at high jump.
Okay.
But I wasn't good enough to represent the school on track because we had some fantastic athletes at KC. KC won schoolboy championships for 13 years. In a row. So all the time I was at KC, we won the schoolboy championships every year and we produced some really top athletes. When I went there first, we had Lennox Miller,
right,
who was at the same time as Donald Quarry. And then we had a lot of great athletes through the years after that.
Okay. And so how quickly did people identify you were going to be good at cricket particularly?
Well, I think my schoolmaster at a pretty early age, Trevor Parchment, decided that he thought I would be better at cricket because, as I said, I played everything. And I was actually playing football and keeping goal at one point, playing outside right at another point.
Were you any good?
Not really. But I represented the school at under 16 level, playing outside right. But Mr. Trevor Parchment, who was the sports master at KC, said to me once, "Mikey, I think you better forget this football thing. I think you should be okay at cricket." And he saw that I was bowling okay, and he pushed me in that direction. But away from school, I still played all the sports. I mean, I was on holidays with my friends. We used to have a park behind where I lived. I say park, but it was a gully course, actually. And when it rained heavily, we couldn't go down there to do anything. But when it was dry, we went down there, we played football, we played cricket, we played marbles. We used to ride the skate on the section that was eventually concrete so that the water could flow freely. No, we had a ball of a time.
Well, listen, we'll hear more about that in just a second. I must say, given your running, and for the people who are too young to remember Michael, go on YouTube and watch him running in from the boundary. He may not have had the longest run-up in world cricket. I guess Bob Willis would contest that with him. When I asked you the question about athleticism, I thought, because as a cricketer, you became a middle-distance runner anyway, didn't you?
I ran a long way.
In the course of a game, you must have run 15 miles. Listen, in the next part here of My Sporting Life, we'll look at your continued progression in cricket as you make your impact on a national level with the island of Jamaica before going on to make your test debut for the West Indies. You're listening to My Sporting Life here on TalkSport. My guest this evening is the West Indies great Michael Holding.
So me track is a bowling, a big old axe about the bowling. Him say me check Michael Holding.
Yeah, if you ever want to know the esteem with which Michael Holding is held, even in that endless battery and production line of great West Indian fast bowlers, that, my friends, is the late, great Jamaican MC Prince Farai and his song Tribute to Michael Holding. He didn't choose Andy Roberts, he didn't choose Malcolm Marshall, he didn't choose Ian Bishop, he chose Michael Holding. He's my guest here today on My Sporting Life.
Might have been a bit of parochialism there, also, he's from Jamaica.
Yeah, of course he is. He worked with the great Michael Williams, he's from Jamaica. And of course, Holding happens to rhyme with bowling, so that there's a little bit of that. Don't do yourself down. Oh, you think that if he'd been a calypso artist, he'd have chosen a Trinidadian, yeah?
More than likely.
Yeah, definitely. More than likely. You played club cricket for a club called Melbourne, who your father was associated with.
Yeah.
And in the early 70s, you must have developed pretty quickly because you were playing for Jamaica, and I presume they had a pretty good cricket team by the time you were a late teenager, 18. How did this all come about?
Yeah, well, I played for Melbourne before I actually played for my school team because, you know, Melbourne Cricket Club, as you said, my father was associated with the club. He later became president for a few years. But when I was born, when my father, because I was born at home, 29 on Robbing Avenue, in the master bedroom. No hospital and all that sort of thing. And the midwife came in. My father wasn't allowed to be in the bedroom.
No.
And the midwife. And
everything's
my
changed
mother,
now.
Yeah, everything's changed now. You're expected to be in there holding hands. Well, anyway, he was standing by the door, and perhaps this is the story I'm getting. He heard the crying or whatever, and he pushed his head in. And the midwife said, it's a boy. And he left immediately and registered me at Melbourne Cricket Club.
A man of great vision.
Yeah, so I've been a member a member of Melbourne for 60 years now. And, you know, as soon as I was able to start playing sport and playing games, I started going down to Melbourne and playing cricket. And Melbourne used to have a team that we went out into the rural areas on a Sunday to play against the bauxite companies and to play against teams out in what we call the country areas in Jamaica. And so I would play in these teams from a pretty tender age, from I was 10, 11, 12 years old. As a matter of fact, sometimes they would allow me to bowl from the batting crease instead of actual stumps because I was struggling. That's because I didn't start growing until I was about 16, 17 years old. I was struggling to get the ball up to the batsman from the stumps, so they would allow me to bowl from the batting crease. So that's where my grounding started. I was playing at Melbourne and started playing minor cup at Melbourne, doing well in the minor cup teams at Melbourne. And then the sports master, same Mr. Trevor Parchman, heard that I was playing cricket at Melbourne and I was not playing cricket at KC. And he sent for me one day at KC and said, I hear you're playing for Melbourne. Why aren't you playing KC? Just something that I just didn't bother to think about or didn't bother to try. And he made me go to practice and then I started playing junior colts at KC. And a matter of fact, my first captain at KC is the great George Headley's, one of the great George Headley's sons, because he had quite a few sons. And he was a fantastic cricketer called Sidney Headley. And if you ever speak to Ron Headley, who lives here now, he'll tell you how good a cricketer Sidney Headley was. Because Sidney Headley was playing junior colts, which was under 14s or something like that. And he was still playing Sunlight Cup, which is a senior team at KC.
Right.
So he was about 14, 15 years old, playing captain in the junior coach team and still being able to play for the senior team, which was 19 and under. And that's where I started at KC and just went through the ranks. Junior Colts, Sunlight Cup.
Were you also a fast bowler, Michael, always?
Not really. When I was playing in the backyard and playing in the gully course that I referred to, I was bowling off breaks. Okay. Trying to bowl off breaks, trying to bat. What developed me or made me choose to be a fast bowler and helped me along the way was the fact that when you're playing that informal cricket that we call catch-a-shubby, there's a gentleman now here in England who is trying to do a more formalised form of catch-a-shubby, Tony Moody, here in London, in Lambeth, as a matter of fact.
Right.
But the informal catch-a-shubby that we played was a matter of whoever had the ball would bowl. The first person to get there with a bat would bat. And if you hit the ball in the air and somebody caught that ball, that person would then bat. It wasn't the bowler who batted. So the only way a bowler could get to bat was either forming partnerships, as they call it those days, that you'd have your friends that would feel for you and they'd feed you the ball because they thought you were the better bowler. And if you got somebody out by one of them catching the catch, or you hitting the stumps. And the stumps were not sticks. The stumps were corrugated iron, so that when you hit them, it made a noise. And no one could ever argue that they weren't out. And that is where you got to bat. Nowhere there are no umpires. So if you weren't somebody that bowled fast, the guys would just keep their legs in the way.
Yeah.
And you couldn't hit those stumps. So I decided if I hit them on the leg on a couple of occasions.
Hard enough.
The next time they saw me coming with the ball, they might not want to put their legs in the way. So that is why I started to bowl fast.
Well, you must have been good at it because, as I say, you make your debut, you play for Jamaica as an 18-year-old. You play, I think, your first full game against Barbados in January of 73. What are your recollections of getting into the Jamaican team? I mean, this must be a huge thing to get into the Jamaican team. Never mind what's
in
this team.
Yeah, definitely. I was still at school when I got into the Jamaica team. And, you know, playing Sunlight Cup, which was the senior level at school, you didn't have to be as fit as you needed to be to play first-class cricket. And I had no clue. And when I went into the Jamaica team, still at school, and they're talking about this young fast bowler, you know, you hear people start to talk. And I then think to myself, I'm in the big man league. If they're talking about me being a young fast bowler, I've got to run in and bowl fast, which is not something I was accustomed to doing at schoolboy level. I would run in, yes, bowl as fast as I possibly could, but not sprinting in. And I got carried away, Daddy. I got carried away in my first game. And after 5 overs, I was pooped. I was flat out. When I walked down the fine leg, Maurice Foster was the captain of the Jamaica team then. When I walked down the fine leg, I was leaning on the fence and hoping that he wouldn't ask me to bowl another over. I don't even remember what happened in the next over that I bowled because he did call me to bowl a 6th over. And I just floated through that over. I was in oblivion. I had no idea. I was so tired. But you learn. You know, that was just a youngster trying to get into the Jamaica team. I had no idea what it took.
What was the standard of West Indian cricket like? I mean, inter-island cricket at that time.
It was pretty high. We had some outstanding West Indies cricketers who all played in our regional tournament. Those days, not many people played county cricket from Jamaica,
sure.
So everybody was available for the regional tournament. And, of course, you had people like Lawrence Rowe, who became a great West Indian batsman, Maurice Foster, who played for the West Indies, Yutan Dow, who also played for the West Indies. We had a lot of cricketers from Jamaica who were very good cricketers, and of course the other islands had their big cricketers as well. Viv Richards was just about coming on the scene, and the Roberts, as a matter of fact, the first time I got selected into the Jamaica squad, I wasn't in the final 11. And the Roberts was in the combined island squad as well, and not in the final 11. That is how we met.
Okay.
We sat on the benches at Spina Park, being 12 men for our respective teams, and we just bonded there. We had great friendship. And the very next year, we both were in our senior teams. And meeting at that age and just going right through our careers as friends.
I mean, it wasn't a full-time job, cricket, in the West Indies in those days. We'll talk about money later on, because, of course, you were involved with Kerry Packer. We'll come on to that.
Yes, for sure.
You got a job in a bank.
Yes. Actually, my first job was at Barclays Bank, as it was then. It's no longer Barclays in Jamaica. It's now called National Commercial Bank because it was nationalized and whatever. But my first job in Jamaica was at the Barclays Bank in their computer department. As a matter of fact, I started working about 3-4 months before the computer department was actually up. They were putting the computer
the very first
together.
Computers, I presume.
Yes,
yeah.
The very first time banking was being computerized in Jamaica. And I think this was now 1974. And they started taking on staff because they wanted to procure the staff, and then they would put everything together. So for the first 3-4 months I was going to work, I was doing absolutely nothing. Sitting down, Brilliant. Having a chat, being paid. Not a lot of money, but in those days, I felt it was a lot of money. I felt rich. I was getting $120 Jamaica dollars a month, and I felt that I was a rich man.
You must develop, because your first call up to play for the West Indies is in the tour of 1975-6 of Australia. Now,
yes.
What I got to say here is that within 2 or 3 years, we're going to be hearing about the start of the greatest cricket team possibly that I can ever remember. I will talk about the Australian team that followed you and the comparisons later on. But this first tour you went on, I'm going to have to be careful what I say here. I've written down the word disastrous. I've written down the word shambles here in front of me.
It was disastrous.
You lost 5-1, and you yourself didn't get on very well. Tell us about that tour of Australia.
No, well, it was a 6-test match tour. I missed 1 test match. I played in 5 test matches.
Yeah.
Danny, I got 10 wickets in 5 test matches. So it was a complete disaster for me. As a matter of fact, I think that my figures for the test matches were 10 wickets for 642 runs or 624 runs. So you're talking about an average of 60-odd runs per wicket.
Yeah, but you are the new kid on the block, to be fair to you.
Yeah, but I played in the very first test match. I went to Australia not expecting to really play, to be honest. And then I did well in this game, state game, leading up to the first test match in Brisbane. And Derek Murray came to me before we played against...
Yeah.
Yes, he was the wicketkeeper then. Came to me, and I think he was vice-captain as well at the same time. He came to me before... the West Indies team played against Queensland, which is a lead-up game to the test match, and said to me, Mikey, you won't be playing against Queensland. So I was a little bit worried. I thought I'd done something. Why am I being dropped? And he said to me, you're not playing because you're playing in the test match. I was shocked out of my wits. I never ever believed I would be playing in the test series at all, much less the first test match. First innings I bowled in that first test match, 0. Danny, 0 wickets. I think I perhaps went over 100 runs as well. 0 wickets. But I did one good thing. I ran out Ian Redpath from fine leg.
Yeah.
And they got to realise that I had a fairly strong arm.
Well, they won't run on your arm again, will they? That's for sure. I mean, there's another issue. I mean, you're an emotional guy, Michael.
It's
clear.
Still
absolutely. We'll talk later on about kicking over the stumps in a test match. An image that, you know, it's indelibly seared into the mind of anybody who watched test cricket over the last 40 years. But there's an incident with the umpires in this series where you cry on the pitch.
Sydney test match. We went to Sydney. I think the Sydney test was the 4th test of the series. We lost in Brisbane. We won in Perth, we lost in Melbourne, and Sydney was the 4th test match, and we were desperate to try and win that test match to get back on even terms. And I came up with, after tea, I think the first ball after tea, I got a wicket. I think it might have been Redpath. And the very next ball, in my opinion, and in most people's opinion, I got another wicket, which was Ian Chappell.
Which is an important wicket to be
very,
getting.
Very, very important wicket. Ian Chappell is a world-class batsman, yeah. And he was scoring lots of runs in that series. He and his brother, Greg. And the umpire said, not out. And I just could not believe it. I had seen instances in the test matches before where, umpires made bad decisions or gave out when they weren't. Or
we should make the point, this is at a time when, of course, both the standing umpires were home umpires
as
well.
Yes, that's long before the international panel.
Absolutely.
A long, long time before the international panel. And to be honest, I broke down. I couldn't believe it. I could not believe that something that was as obvious as that, that the umpire could have said, not out. Because as a young man growing up, as you made the point earlier on, Danny, I went to Australia very inexperienced. I think I'd played 5 games for Jamaica before I went to Australia. That's why I didn't expect to play. And as a young man growing up and you hear your parents talking about cricket and hearing about the gentleman's game, you just assume that when somebody was out, he was out. And because of the emotion of the moment and the fact that we were behind in the series and desperate to win this test match, and this was now going to be our breakthrough to get back on even terms, I just lost it. I went out to a perhaps extra cover somewhere around there, and I knelt down, and the tears came to my eyes. I think it was Lance Gibbs who ran over to me from gully.
Bless him.
And said, Mikey, you have to continue. And
I'm laughing about it now, but it's obviously not funny for you at the time.
Not at the time. Definitely not at the time.
So in the middle of the over, you stopped and you're crying, and Lance Gibbs, the great spin bowler, has to come and say, come on, guy, you've got to go again.
Yeah, I think that over took about 9 minutes to be completed, because those days it was 8 ball overs. And it took me a long time to really compose myself and get back to my crease, to my marker rather.
After that disastrous start for you and a disastrous tour for the West Indies, that you then play India back in the islands.
Yeah.
I should say in South America as well, because the Guyanese people have got to get this right, haven't I?
Still just call it West Indies.
Yeah, the West Indies, yeah. And Clive Lloyd, the captain, it's a quite close series, but something happens there that is the start of the change of the history of world cricket. Tell us about that.
Well, what really spurred the change was a test match before we actually won the series in Jamaica. It was a test match in Trinidad. The theory... Everyone said when you go to Trinidad, you play at spinners because Trinidad produced a lot of spinners. Inshan Ali and Rafiq Jumadeen and lots of spinners. Imtiaz Ali. And when the test match against India was being played in Trinidad, they selected three spinners. And Clive Lloyd, obviously being part of the selection panel, was a part of the selection of the three spinners. We lost that test match.
Did you play, yeah?
Yeah, I
you
played.
You and three spinners, yeah?
Myself, I'm not too sure if Andy played because Andy... Perhaps I think Andy missed out. I think Bernard, Julian and myself were the two new ball bowlers.
Yeah.
And then we had three spinners. And we declared the second innings and set India 400 and something, 14 or something like that.
A huge amount to make.
A huge amount of money. Not money, amount of runs.
To make, yeah.
And they knocked them off 4 wickets down, I think. And one of the 4 wickets went by the run-out route. And Lloyd decided there and then, no more talk about this pitch suits this and that pitch suits whatever. We'll play our best bowlers. We'll pick 4 fast bowlers if they are the 4 best bowlers, which it was because we had Andy Roberts, we had myself, we had Van Bernholder, we had Bernard Julian, we had Keith Boyce, we had Wayne Daniel. All those guys were fast bowlers available around that time. And Lloyd just decided we'll pick the 4 best bowlers. We went to Jamaica. 4 fast bowlers played in Jamaica and we won the test match there in Jamaica. I don't think India really appreciated some of the tactics that we used, and I'll openly say that yes, it was a little bit harsh sometimes. We went round the wicket and bowled quite a few bounces and that sort of a thing, but it proved successful in that series, in that particular test match, and Lloyd just carried that forward, decided that the best bowlers would play and they happened to be fast bowlers.
And this idea gets it, that was actually a close series. This idea gets its first chance to be tried out properly in the summer of 1976 for people like myself who saw two of the bits and pieces of two of the tests, unforgettable. The West Indies team comes here after Tony Gregg, the England captain, had used an unfortunate word and said he was going to make these people grovel.
Yeah.
And I think given the historic links and the story of what happened in the Caribbean, it was a poor word to choose. It was also, I should tell people, the summer of 1976 was the hottest summer of the 20th century. The reservoirs dried up.
The motorways were melting.
The parks were bright white. The grass died and all the rest of it. It suited the West Indies team. And you came here, and with this battery of fast bowlers, not yet by any means the fastest battery you were to produce.
Not yet.
But still with yourself at the spearhead and Andy Roberts, of course, the great Andy Roberts. You made an absolute mess of English cricket and won 5-0. And it's stuck in my memory.
No, that series was 3-0.
Sorry, 3-0.
3-0, that series.
Yeah. We'll come on to the 5-0s a bit later on. But it was the one in 76 when people said, oh, my God, something's happening here.
Yeah, well, I just said it was a fantastic summer as far as weather is concerned. And we, the West Indians, of course, we relished the warmth. And that series, we got a little bit, as you said, a little bit of a pep in our step because of what Tony Gregg said. And some of us
didn't actually... Did it affect you, yeah?
Definitely. Yeah. Some of us didn't see it live, but heard about it afterwards. Because those days, when a touring team came to England, they never played on a Sunday. Even test matches, Sunday was the rest day.
Right.
And so we were resting on that Sunday, but they had the joint player league, I think it was.
Yeah, the old 40, 50 overs thing. Yeah.
Yes. And the Sussex were playing down at Hove. And the BBC cameras turned up at Hove to interview the England captain, Tony Gregg. And I remember him speaking, I don't remember who was interviewing him, but I remember him speaking, I suppose, in someone's office at the ground and saying that, you know, when the West Indies are on top, they are brilliant, but when they are down, they grovel, and I, with the help of Closey and a few others, intend to make them grovel. And as you said, it was an unfortunate word because with his background...
Being South African, of course,
yes,
we still had apartheid in that
country. Apartheid was still going on at the time. And we had our backs up. And every time he came to the crease, I think the fast bowlers found an extra yard or two of pace. And the other batsmen who batted with him were upset whenever they had to bat with him, because, of course, they would feel the heat as well.
One of those batsmen was a gentleman brought in to try and combat this, described in the film, of course, as Fire Over Babylon.
Fire in Babylon.
Yeah, absolutely. Fire in Babylon when it arrived in England. And was the great batsman, Brian Close. And I'm delighted to say he joins us now. Hello, Brian.
Hello there. How are you?
Very, very good indeed. And say hello to Michael. He's a safe distance away now.
Oh, are you, Closey?
I'm very well. And you?
I am very good, thanks.
Are you still turning your arm over?
No, Closey. No, I stopped that quite a few years ago. 10 years ago, I played my last game.
There's still some fine muscles. I think he might be lifting the occasional glass of red wine towards with it.
Brian, that would be nice, wouldn't it?
Brian, I had the privilege of watching Michael Holding running in from 45 yards, but I was on the safe side of the rope. Describe Michael Holding as a bowler and your experience against him in the summer of 1976 here in England.
Well, he was a bit sharp. There were two of the... Well, in fact, him and Wes Hall were the two fastest I've ever run across in
a generation
in my
apart,
years
but very quick, yeah.
And they were a great side in 76, and as Michael's just been saying, Greggy was stupid opening his bloody mouth.
Brian, let me ask you a question. Often it was said of you that if you're up against bowlers who were particularly quick or trying to hurt you and stuff, you just stand there and wear them, as they say. But really, could you really do that against somebody as fast as Michael Holding? Surely you just end up in bits and pieces.
Well, the one thing about it is that you've got to protect your wickets. So, of course, you play back so that you know the wickets are behind you. They can't hit the damn things without they hit you. And... it was a bit... I enjoyed it, actually. It was a great battle.
And not a lot of protection those days either, Closey.
Oh, we didn't have any then.
Exactly.
The only thing you had was a thigh pad.
And a little pink box.
Oh, aye.
Remember those?
Yeah, I do. Nowadays, they have all kinds of blooming things.
Oh, they look like American footballers now, don't
they?
Let's be truthful. Brian, when the dust settled on that series and you counted your bruises, did you think we were going to see a generation of dominance by the West Indian fast bowlers?
Well, ever since the early 60s, the late 50s, the West Indies have always had two or three really great fast bowlers, you know. And I suppose in some respects they're going to keep on producing them, but... it'll take them some doing, though, won't it?
It will, Brian. Thanks. And it's been a joy just to hear your voice and some recollections of that amazing summer of 1976. Thank you very much indeed.
It was good fun afterwards.
Yeah, afterwards.
Looking back.
Yeah, in retrospect. Thank you, Brian.
Take care, Michael.
You too, Closey. Good to speak to you again.
Michael, I'm going to explain what World Series cricket was. It'll save us a lot of time in the long run.
Sure.
In 1977, 78, 79, an Australian entrepreneur called Kerry Prackett decided that cricket was living in the 19th century, the players were getting paid nothing, and he wanted to own all the television rights. As a result, he started to put on alternate test matches and one-day internationals and gathered up all the great players of the world. Indeed, Tony Gregg, of whom we spoke a minute ago, was absolutely central to getting the England players to do it. It was an absolute schism in world cricket. It tore the game apart for 2 or 3 years. Cricket councils wouldn't pick players who played for Packer. Packer said, I'll destroy the game. Everything went up in flames, and you were right in the middle of that as a very young man. Tell us about World Series cricket.
Yes, I was only 23 years old at the time. 1976, we spoke about that earlier on the tour, my first tour here in England, did very well. And when I went back to Jamaica, the Prime Minister at the time, Michael Manley, gave me a scholarship to go to University of the West Indies. And in fact, I was not playing with the West Indies when World Series cricket started, Danny. I had gone to the University of the West Indies in September 1976 to pursue a 4-year course in computer science.
Right.
And Pakistan were touring the Caribbean in 1977 early. I don't remember, February, March, somewhere around that time of the year. And they are in Trinidad, and I get a call from Clive Lloyd while I'm in Jamaica, living at my parents' home, because Lloyd and myself were very, very close. He had my number, my parents' number, of course. Those days, no mobile phones, that sort of thing. Phone rang at my home. Father said, your skipper is on the phone, although I wasn't playing. Still referred to him as my skipper. And when I got the call from Lloyd, he started to tell me about World Series cricket.
I should make the point, all this was happening in great secrecy, cloak and dagger. Because if we had got out, the cricket authorities would have stopped it.
Oh, they would have found some way of trying to stop it or definitely stopping it. He told me about World Series cricket, and this man from Australia was trying to do private enterprise cricket, as it was called. And he said two people would come and see me in Jamaica to discuss it with me. And I said to him, who are these people? And he said, Tony Gregg and Austin Robertson. And when he said Tony Gregg, because I remember this is just after 76, yeah, the 76 tour. When he said Tony Gregg, I said to him, Tony Gregg, I don't want to talk to Tony Gregg. And he said, no. He just listen to what they have to say. So eventually Tony Gregg and Austin Robertson arrive in Jamaica, and we go to the Sheraton Hotel. And I meet them in this room. They start telling me about this Kerry Packer and showing me pamphlets and thing about his Woman's Weekly magazine and his television station, Channel 9, and what he owns and what he doesn't own. And I simply said to them, listen, Skipper Lloyd says that he has signed, just show me where to sign. I didn't want to hear anything else.
You trusted Clive enough?
Yeah, once Clive said he had signed and he saw no problem with it, I was happy to sign. Plus, what they also guaranteed us, what a lot of people are not aware of, Danny, is Kerry Packer guaranteed that the West Indians would always be available to play for the West Indies. Now, that is being selfish. I only looked at that. I only looked at the fact that West Indies cricket was not being disrupted. And to be even more selfish, I was not playing for the West Indies. I had gone to university. I had pretty much put cricket on the back burner. I was now thinking of a career after cricket, because cricket wasn't paying any money.
No.
The series that I played, my first ever series in Australia, Centrefire 76, I earned 1,500 Eastern Caribbean dollars, which converted to about 600 US dollars. Coming back to play India in the Caribbean, we got 200 US dollars per test. We went to Guyana, the test match was washed out, we got nothing. So I wasn't earning money from cricket, and my mother kept on telling me from years ago when I was at school farming the ass and trying and playing at sport, Mikey, you have got to have a piece of paper behind your name. Because later on, you need to get a job, you need to be qualified. So I had moved on. So when this man came and offered 25,000 Australian dollars per year, 3 years guaranteed, there's no way I could turn my back on that.
I'm interested to note when reading about this that the only other thing that was an issue for you, and I don't know if it was an issue for other West Indians, we shouldn't forget, we still had the apartheid regime in South Africa, and you didn't play against the South Africans, and I think you were very strong on this, but there were going to be lots of South Africans in the World Series of Cricket, and this was an issue for you.
Yes, well, because of Michael Manley again, who was big against apartheid, he led the Glen Eagles Agreement up in Scotland.
This is the Jamaican Prime Minister.
Prime Minister, yes. And he had given me the scholarship to go to university.
Yes.
So I had a great respect for him, and I also knew what he stood for. And when Tony Gregg and Austin Robertson showed me the list of names that I had already signed, I said to them, listen, I cannot play against these South Africans. My Prime Minister will not allow me to play against these South Africans. So Mr. Packer or whoever has to clear this with Mr. Michael Manley before I can even come to Australia. And I said, yes, we'll make sure that when we get back to Australia that it is sorted. I said, unless it is sorted, you do not have me, I'll sign. But unless that is sorted, I'm not coming. And eventually Kerry Packer paid off all the South Africans who had not played in county cricket, because that's the agreement that Kerry Packer and Michael Manley had. Michael Manley said, okay, I'll allow my boys to play against the South Africans who are playing county cricket, because they play against them in county cricket now. But the South Africans who are not playing county cricket, I think there are about three or four of them, I'm not going to allow my boys to come to Australia to play against them.
It worked. I mean, World Series cricket was an amazing thing. Dennis Lilly, Rod Marsh, Tony Gregg, Alan Knott, Derek Underwood, Zaheer Abbas, Eddie Barlow, Imran Khan. I could go on and on.
A lot
of fantastic big names played, often in empty stadiums, and often to
the first year, yes.
Yes, that's right, the first year. Great hostility in the press, people calling you mercenaries,
yes.
Rebels. How did that feel to you?
Well, we were dumbfounded, first of all. We didn't appreciate what was actually taking place and what it meant to the rest of world cricket. As I said, especially me, I am 23 years old. I am naive to exactly what impact it's going to have on world cricket. At the same time, selfish. I'm just thinking about myself. I'm going to be blunt. The money was just too big to refuse. Sure. But when all this started to take place, you know, we sit down with Richards, Clive Lloyd, myself, Andy Roberts, we sit down and we think to ourselves, you know, have we done the right thing here? Because, you know, all the backlash. But then people in the Caribbean were supporting us. And we were still able to play for the West Indies. We still went back after the first year of World Series cricket and played for the West Indies. So although the rest of the world was getting all hot and heated about this thing, we were feeling the heat, yes, but not as much as, say, the guys here in England or some of the other guys from around the rest of the world.
Yeah. It lasted 2 years. It was supposed to be a 3 years, but eventually, of course, an agreement was reached. Peace broke out in world cricket.
Yep.
You say you made some decent money for the first time, and you got a new car out of this, Michael.
Well, it was new in a sense, new to me. It wasn't a brand new car. It was a second-hand car. It was actually a rental.
Car was it?
It was a Gallant.
I don't remember them. Who made those?
Mitsubishi. Mitsubishi Gallant, yes.
Well, that was the embodiment of the progress you'd made.
Yes, for sure, because I couldn't ever think of buying a car in those days.
Incredible. That's World Series cricket, and thank you for that. Next up here on My Sporting Life, it's time for Michael Holding to endure your Sporting Inquisition.
Your Sporting Inquisition on Talk Sport. Michael Holding.
Yeah, that music's very foreboding, isn't it? But it's not quite as bad as that. You know the format. About 20 questions of the sort that might have been asked in a 1970s football magazine. And we'll get Michael Holding's answers to them. Some of them will be more interesting than others, I imagine. Here we go. Your favourite sporting venue?
Sabina Park. That's home.
That's very parochial of you.
Yes, definitely.
Who's your toughest opponent?
Ian Chappell. As a youngster bowling against Ian Chappell, it wasn't easy.
Hence the crying at my leg or wherever it was.
When I got him out, I felt I had achieved something, turned to be nothing.
What's your favourite city?
Sydney, Australia. I love Sydney.
It's a beautiful place, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. With the harbour and all that.
We heard about your Gallant, but what's the best car you've ever driven?
I bought a Mercedes-Benz here in England in 1980, and then I've been driving one here in England again for the last 4 or 5 years.
You like that?
Yes,
What's your favourite driving song?
There's a lot of songs that I like to listen to. One of them that I listened to a lot when I was at Derby was Dancing on the Ceiling, Lionel Richie, because it had an upbeat tempo. And I hope the police officers aren't listening, but I used to drive fast those days. So, you know, the tempo and the driving went together.
Can't do it now, the cameras and all that.
No, exactly.
Here we go. Viv Richards, I'm going to sit back in case you swing at me. Viv Richards or Brian Lara?
Viv Richards, by a distance.
Yeah. I'll talk about that maybe later on. What's your favourite drink?
Lemonade. Simple water, lime, and it's not even lemon. Limes in Jamaica. Limes, water and sugar. I still enjoy it.
Okay. If you could be a star in another sport other than cricket, which one would you choose?
Athletics. I wish I could have been a 400 metres hurdler.
Okay.
Did hurdles at school and I loved it.
Who would you pick to play you in a film?
Oh, Denzel Washington.
Yeah, he's the man, isn't he?
He is the man, definitely.
Which historical figure do you most admire?
Mandela. I never met him, and that is one of the saddest things in my life. Never got to meet a great man.
That's a shame, because several people who've done this programme have met him, and of course they all talk about it in this kind of
greatest man ever.
Who's your favourite cartoon character?
Mickey Mouse. Okay. I use that term regularly.
Very old school, it is, Mostly to describe West Indian pace bowling. And what was your best moment in cricket?
My best moment in cricket was being a member of the West Indies team in 1979-80 that beat Australia in Australia for the very first time. The first ever West Indies team to beat Australia in Australia. I'll live with that forever.
And you know what? We're going to hear a lot about that in the second half of My Sporting Life. As I say, because still to come, we'll be discussing the remainder of your Test career. We'll be talking about winning the World Cup. We'll be including your perfect over against Jeff Boycott, your controversial stump-kicking incident at Dunedin against New Zealand. The World Cup final defeat in India in 1983, plus your time playing county cricket here for Lancashire and Derbyshire, and much else besides, because you're listening to My Sporting Life with me, Danny Kelly, here on TalkSport. But much more importantly, my guest tonight, who is the mighty Michael Holding.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
On DAB Digital Radio and 1089 and 1053 AM. My Sporting Life on Talk Sport.
Yeah, I'm Danny Kelly. Welcome to part two of My Sporting Life with Michael Holding here on Talk Sport. And Michael is one of the greatest and most fearsome fast bowlers in the history of Test cricket, a reputation gained for his performances in the legendary West Indies side, which dominated the sport throughout the 70s and 80s. In 60 Test matches for the Windies, he took 249 wickets, including 14 for 149 against England at the Oval in the summer of 1976, the finest match figures still ever produced by a West Indian. He's also remembered for arguably the most ferocious over ever in Test cricket against Geoffrey Boycott at the Kensington Oval in 1981 when he smashed the English batsman's wicket with a six ball. While in the One Day International Arena, he took 142 wickets and 102 appearances, and he was a member of the West Indies side which won the 1979 World Cup. He also represented Jamaica, Lancashire, Tasmania, Derbyshire and Canterbury in first-class cricket, and after retiring from the playing side of the game in 1989, he's forged a successful media career as a respected cricket commentator, as well as spending time as an ICC official. On tonight's My Sporting Life, I'm joined by the West Indies cricket legend that is Michael Holding. Michael, if we might stray away from the Test arena just for a second or two. The West Indies, as we heard earlier on, had won the inaugural World Cup, and they defended their trophy in 1979 here in England.
Yeah.
And the young Holding was in that team as well.
Yeah. Well, I didn't play in the centre five team, but I played centre nine.
No, quite. That's what I'm saying. I mean, you were here for this. A big thing, and the One Day World Cup. It wasn't quite the razzmatazz of now. It
Not
was establishing itself, wasn't
just
it?
Just establishing itself, the one-day games, as a matter of fact. I don't think I played a one-day international until about 1976 because I wasn't a part of the West Indies team in 75. And I think when we came to England in 76, we played like 3 one-day games for the summer. So it wasn't something that was well-established at international level. But the 79 World Cup was a big thing. We had won in 75. We wanted to defend our throne. We came close to losing a semi-final. I think it was against Pakistan at the Oval. But I think we did pretty well in the rest of the games.
Well, I mean, I'm just looking at the squad that you brought. And with all due respect to one or two of the Van Burn holders and one or two of the fast medium bowlers that you mentioned to me earlier on, and when you talk about the fast bowling attack, let me just remind people that for the 19th, this is a one-day match, don't forget, the West Indies brought Michael Holding, Colin Croft, Joel Garner, Andy Roberts and Malcolm Marshall. They can't all play, but that's plenty for most people, isn't it? You're absolutely right here. You beat in the group stages India, there was no result against Sri Lanka, beat New Zealand, that semi-final against Pakistan, and then the final against England. What do you remember about that? I know what I remember, but I don't want to talk about the slow pace of England's batting. What do you remember about that?
No, well, what I remember, first of all, the slow pace of England's batting came later on, was Bibb Richards' innings. And, of course, with the help of Collis King. We were struggling a little bit. We lost some early wickets. And Bibb and Collis King put a partnership together that pretty much won the game for us. I remember Bibb hitting the last ball of the innings off Mike Hendrick for six in the Tavern Stand,
yeah,
I think it's
tavern
called.
Stand, yeah,
hit last ball of the innings for six. And when he and Collis walked off the field, I think we all pretty much thought to ourselves, this is too much. No, England are not going to get these runs. Although it was 60 overs at the time, Danny.
Yeah.
But although it was 60 overs, we didn't have field restrictions. So you could set your fielders anywhere. So getting that number of runs in 60 overs was going to be a difficult task.
Plus, with all due respect, England hadn't really worked out how to play one-day cricket. And Jeff Boycott and Mike Brearley were happy to go along at 1.5 an over for half the game.
Yeah, the opening partnership put a good number of runs together, but
it took a lot of time.
It took a very, very long time.
I mean, obviously, fantastic thing to win that trophy and be world champion. Your own bowling figures and your 8 overs, 2 for 16. That's not bad in any one day cricket, is it?
I wasn't even aware of that. I didn't know that the figures were good.
In fact, you got Brearley and Boycott out.
Okay. Yeah,
so that wasn't really helping the West Indies. They needed to stay in.
I think Clive Lloyd dropped a catch somewhere during that partnership, and people said that he dropped it purposely.
Yeah, because they're never going to win this game. They might stay in for the whole thing, but
they were scoring
all
too slowly.
All seriousness, to win it at the home of cricket, as we call Lords, must have been a fantastic feeling.
It was a great feeling. You know, the World Cup, beating the entire world, you know, it was a big event. So just starting off, they were trying to promote this one-day World Cup, and to win it both times it was played was a great feeling. You know, the West Indies, that is. Now, some of the guys who played 79 were around in 75, but just to know that the West Indies had won both occasions, that was a great feeling.
That's not enough time for the World Cup, but I've got so much to get through. I'm going to leave it behind now, because immediately after that, the West Indian team, which is beginning to really start to look like it's going to dominate, as it turns out, for 20 years, goes to Australia, then I guess the next most powerful team in the world, or then the most powerful team in the world, depending on how you look at it. West Indies had never won in Australia.
Never.
And you and your colleagues, again, with that Holding, Roberts, Garner, Croft, etc., and some batsmen that we'll talk about, you go there and you won the series 2-0. What are your recollections of that? I mean, you mentioned to us 10 minutes ago that it's perhaps the highlight of your career.
It is, definitely. It was a three-test series. I think that year it was shared. I think two teams toured Australia that Australian summer. And we only played three test matches. And we went in the last test match at Adelaide. If we had lost that test match, the series would have been drawn 1-1. Yeah. And we were desperate to win that test match. And Clive Lloyd, I think, played a major part, because we batted last chasing some runs. Clive Lloyd played a major part. He and Larry Gomes, I think, put a very good partnership together and got those runs. And believe me, all the fast bowlers ran out onto the pitch and lifted Lloyd onto our shoulders and to take him off the field.
That's quite a lot of man to lift up as well.
Yeah, but we were big guys, you know, Colin Croft, Joel Garner, you know, big guys.
We'll talk later on about the fast bowling battery and the controversy about the way you went about your business and all that. But sometimes I think it gets overlooked in all of this that the West Indies also were developing and eventually developed the most powerful batting lineup that we're probably, certainly had been ever seen up to then. Perhaps the Australians of 15, 20 years later could match them. Maybe the Indian batting of 5 or 6 years ago in terms of sheer runs. But just remind us of some of the people you were playing with at that time.
Well, early days, Roy Fredericks was the opening batsman. But by the time we really established ourselves and became world dominant, it was Greenidge and Haynes opening the batting.
Still the most prolific opening partnership ever.
For West Indies, I don't think it's the most prolific ever. I think
you think Langer and Hayden overtook.
I am not great on statistics, yeah. Daddy, but I think I remember hearing something about them.
Well, I did Matthew Hayden for this program about 6 weeks ago, and he doesn't think so. He thinks that
still Haynes. Okay.
Okay. Well,
I'm happy to take it.
They were a fantastic opening partnership.
Fantastic opening partnership. And then, of course, you had Bibb Richards coming in at number three. But I'll take you back to that Test match at Lords, when David Gore declared setting West Indies over 300 runs to make in less than a day. Bibb Richards did not even get a chance to bat. Greenidge made a double century and Larry Gomes came in at number three. So just to show you the strength of the batting lineup, because Lloyd came in after that. We had Geoffrey Dujon batting at seven as a wicketkeeper batsman. He made centuries, not many centuries, because he didn't get a long time to bat most of the times. But we had a strong batting lineup.
Gordon was limping, was he, when he got that 200?
More than likely. Yeah, whenever he limped, you were in trouble.
Yeah, because he was making out something wrong with him. I'll just make the point there that in that Australian series, which did, of course, establish you as the best team in the world, Viv Richards made 140 at Brisbane, 96 at Melbourne, 76, 74 at Adelaide. But at this stage, they were struggling to get him out, even a very good Australian attack.
Yeah.
We must talk about something else. You went on from that brilliant series to New Zealand. And the umpiring, which of course has changed now, but the umpiring caused a lot of problems. I don't think you thought you were getting the right end of it. In fact, the West Indies eventually went on strike over the umpiring, and you famously kicked the stumps over when you didn't get a decision. We'll talk about why you did it. Here's how you did it.
All played at this one. Loud appeal for the court behind. Well, this is a display of emotion by Michael Holding. Appeal for the court behind. We'll watch this one. There is playing at it. Didn't look like he got the edge.
Michael Holding has shown rather more frustration than one would anticipate or expect.
That was being kind.
A very contained commentary there. The actual photograph, of course, I mean, you were a pretty fit man in those days.
Yeah.
You've kicked a stump and your leg is like a dancing girl. It's way above head height and you're a tall bloke. I mean, it's incredible.
You took
an incredible swipe at it.
Yes, it was a frustration. You know, that was the first test match in Dunedin. And we had pretty much enough, or I had enough, because it continued throughout the rest of the series. But the umpiring was atrocious.
I think, biased.
There's no way it was all mistakes. You can't make mistakes in one direction. And I think during that commentary, the first time I'm actually hearing, you heard Desmond Haynes in the background shouting, come on, man. Because it had been going on, and this is just the first test match. And the batsman was Parker. I don't remember his first name. And he heard the commentator say he can't detect an edge. There was no edge. It didn't hit the bat. It hit his glove. And he was taking his gloves off because the ball had hit his glove that hard. And he was looking to head towards the pavilion because the pavilion was side on in front of him. And his bat is under his arm. If you look at the picture, you'll see it. One glove off, bat under his arm. And he looks at the umpire and the umpire just shakes his head. So he just stood there and put the glove back on. And when I saw that, I just saw red. The mist came down, as they said. Because, you know, those days, well, I'm still a little bit emotional, but those days I was fiery and emotional.
I mean, nowadays, if it happened, it would have been a global inquiry.
I would have been suspended. I would have been fined. Lots of things would
questions
have happened.
Questions in various parliaments.
There was an inquiry, you know, because there was an official inquiry. And what the New Zealand umpires told the person or the people that were holding the inquiries that we were bowling too fast for them to see the ball. That's why they made so many mistakes. Give me a break.
We could talk about individual test matches and things, and we will come back to some of your bowling and stuff, but I think we need to talk about what that team did and what it meant. You mentioned the film Fire in Babylon, and I think it's definitely true to say that West Indian team came to mean, in the wider world, much more than just a sports team. From my own experience, and I don't want to make too much of this, I knew West Indian kids, British West Indian kids, grew up with in London, who took that team to their hearts as a kind of badge of, okay, we can achieve something beyond what we're being told we can achieve.
Yep.
Were you aware of that when you were playing?
Not initially, to be honest. No. I can't say that in the 76 tour, for instance, that I was aware of exactly that effect we were having.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I knew a lot of West Indians who lived in England, and I knew that they felt good when we won. It made them feel very proud, and it made them feel that they could identify with success. So I knew about that effect, but I didn't know about the wider aspect of it all. And the film Fire in Babylon that you referred to, when that film was being made, by that time, I got to understand exactly what the West Indies team meant to people here in England. And not just people here in England, any West Indian anywhere in the world.
The whole diaspora.
Yeah, the only thing we do in the Caribbean together, Dan, is play cricket. Every other sport is done by that island's team or that country's team.
Let me ask you about that then. I mean, because the idea, the concept of a West Indies, I know there's a University of the West Indies.
Yes.
But it's not a nation. It's a series of small and bigger nations.
A lot of little islands.
Absolutely.
With their own anthems, their own currency, their own flags, their own governments. And now that you mentioned the University of the West Indies, that started off as one campus in Jamaica. Now everybody has their own campus. So we're even splitting up in that regard as well.
So if I asked you, are you a West Indian or are you a Jamaican?
I'm a West Indian.
Yeah,
I'm always
so you
Indian.
Are, there is something there.
Because I played cricket, I identify as a West Indian. I'm proud Jamaican, of course. Mm. And I still have my Jamaican passport. I live in the U.S. now, but I still travel on my Jamaican passport, which gives me a lot of hell in a lot of countries that I go to. But I'll never get rid of my Jamaican passport. So I'm a proud Jamaican, but because I played cricket for the West Indies, I refer to myself as a West Indian. A lot of people in the Caribbean would like to call themselves West Indians. They're not true West Indians.
Like who?
Just people in general. They're only worried about their own island daddy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And especially when it comes to cricket, they'll tell you everything in the book about the person that comes from their island. But talk about other people from other islands, they're not really interested.
Let me ask you this. The current West Indian team, there's been a decline since, I guess, since Lara, Walsh, that generation stopped playing. There's been not just a slow, but a very quick decline in the West Indian cricket team, right? So where they are now, sometimes they win, sometimes they lose. Often they lose shambolically.
True.
If the West Indies cricket team was to fade away to be insignificant, let's say that the famous breakthrough of basketball was to happen in the West Indies, which people say, and of course it's nonsense. But
rubbish.
Yeah, it's nonsense. But that's what they used to say. The basketball was replaced and all the rest of it. Let's say that PlayStation replaces cricket and the West Indies cricket team becomes a sideshow. Will the idea of West Indies disappear then?
Not really, because people still try to think West Indian. You know, even when it comes to business, the CARICOM market, for instance, you know, being able to move products around the Caribbean without attracting duty from one island to the other.
Yeah, like the EU here.
Yeah, that sort of thing.
Theory, so, free trade area.
So that aspect of it, people are still trying to keep together. But the real identity is with cricket, Danny, because a lot of islands in the Caribbean have never produced a test cricketer, but they still talk about we and us, which is what keeps the West Indian region together.
Okay. And, of course, what has been brilliant over the last 20, 30 years is that the West Indian team used to be Jamaica, Barbados, Trinidad, Guyanese players, by and large, you know.
Years gone by before the Combine Islands really got strong.
And now, of course, people Leewards. Coming from little tiny islands to play. Obviously, St. Lucians have played and Antiguans have played and
so on. Well, Viv Richards and Andy Roberts.
Absolutely.
The first two Antiguans.
Absolutely.
Fantastic cricketers.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think Antigua's population is about 60,000, Danny.
Yeah, so like a tiny, not even the size of a London borough.
Exactly.
You know, a small town. We'd call them a big village, a small town in this country.
Yeah.
If we go back to when you were in your pomp, I was watching that over that you bowled some bowling you were doing to Brian Close, we heard from earlier on. Eventually, the umpire intervened and said to you, Michael, that there's enough short pitch bowling. There was criticism, wasn't there? There was genuine criticism about the fact that you were aiming for the body. I don't know whether you were attempting to hurt people. You're certainly not trying to make life comfortable for them. Looking back on that now, do you think it was justified? They changed the rules eventually, didn't they, to stop West Indies doing what they were doing?
Well, they changed the rules, but that should not have stopped any good fast bowler, Danny. They changed the rule to say no more than two balls above shoulder height in any over. Now, why, as a fast bowler, would you want to be bowling balls above shoulder height?
You're not going to get anybody out.
Exactly. So those rules should never have any effect on any good fast bowler. But going back to whether we thought it was justified or not, what we did then, people are doing now. England played four fast bowlers against Australia in 2005, won the Ashes, and they were praised high waters. You know,
Downing Street.
Harmison bowled a bounce and hit Ricky Ponting on his face, and the entire lodge cheered. When the West Indies did it, we are brutal, and that's spoiling the game. That's not cricket. Perhaps we were just before our time.
Yeah.
And we never bowled six bouncers in an over. I saw Mornay Morkel bowl nine bouncers to Michael Clarke in the recent Australia-South Africa series. I worked on the series in South Africa. Nine bouncers in a row. Hit him all over his body. The physiotherapist had to be coming out with spray and all sorts of things. And they said it was fantastic bowling.
You lost the 1983 World Cup final, so we'll skim past that, if you like. And that was followed up. I mean, the reputation of this team of yours in this country, of course, is established because, I mean, of course you were beating India in difficult conditions, winning in Australia.
Yeah.
But there was two series very close together of 10 test matches against England. Where, and this is an England team with lots of good players, particularly good batsmen. People have gone on to have reputations and MBEs.
Oh,
and you beat them 10-0, 5-5. What do you remember about that?
Well, those were great days, believe me, because when we were winning 5-0 here in England, the people, the supporters here in England, they were on top of the world. They travelled to every test venue throughout the country. I remember a guy called Tony that actually was from Leeds, and he had this big drum, because those days the guys could take their musical instruments into the ground and they had a ball. And we were so happy to see them really enjoying themselves and having such a great time of it. You know, it was just a great feeling for us to know that these guys could enjoy it so much.
And yet, you decided in the middle of this great run, you know, and I would say, if you take out one Packer series where there was politics and stuff, West Indies went 20 years without losing a single series. And when I think about that, I can't think. I'm thinking about the All Blacks and I'm thinking about teams that say they've got a dynasty and a legacy. I don't think any sports team, and correct me if I'm wrong, help me, because you must have thought
Well, I'll correct you about the 20 years, because it was 15 years, actually. We lost that same series when I kicked out the stumps. We lost that series in New Zealand, 1-0.
All right.
But from 1975 to 1995, we lost one series.
Right.
From 81 to 95, 15 years, we never lost at all.
Can you think of any other sports
There's no other sports team or sporting personality that has dominated their sport the way we did.
Michael, we've talked a lot about the West Indies and the great players you played with, but of course, at the back of all that, you also were an international cricketer in that you played first-class cricket in several countries, in New Zealand, Australia, and for a long time over here. When I put out on Twitter the fact that I was talking to you, one of the very first questions, of the thousands that people responded to and said, asking, somebody said, when you played club cricket in the Lancashire Leagues for Rishton in 1981, asking if that's the coldest conditions which he's ever played cricket. I have to ask you.
Danny, when I arrived in Lancashire at Rishton, the first week we were supposed to have a game, we couldn't play. It was snowed off. Wilf Woodhouse, who was the chairman of Rishton at the time, met me with a nice, heavy, thick winter coat and some gloves, because I hadn't come prepared for that. And when our game was snowed off, he decided we'd drive over to East Langs to watch their game. But not necessarily just to watch their game, because he knew Andy Roberts was playing over there, and Andy and myself were so close. So we went over there. East Langs, a richer club than Rishton. They had good covers and a fantastic level ground and that sort of a thing. They had the snow as the boundary.
Okay.
It was unbelievable. I thought to myself, what am I doing here?
I'm guessing that your first ever trip to this country would have been in 1976.
Yes.
Where you must have got a very, very inaccurate idea of what the weather in this country was like.
Exactly.
Because it was like the Caribbean or the Caribbean for the whole summer, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I came back in 1980. But 1980 wasn't that bad. We had quite a bit of rain in 1980 in that series. But it wasn't as cold as you could have expected. But when I came back for the Lancashire League in 81, I arrived in April. Oof. Because the touring teams never came here in April.
No. I mean, you played for Lancashire for a little while.
I played a few games for Lancashire.
Yeah,
when I was at Rishton.
Yeah.
Because it was weekend cricket, I played some midweek games for Lancashire. And I enjoyed that. I enjoyed both, really, the Lancashire League with Rishton, because I met some great people in Rishton. And I used to see them every time there was a test match at Old Trafford. Used to go up there and they would come down to Old Trafford.
Did you bowl off your full run-up and as fast as you could in the Lancashire Leagues?
Well, no, because the conditions wouldn't allow. I bowled off pretty close to my full run-up, but the conditions wouldn't allow it to run in and bowl fast. It was always wet, Danny.
Okay.
I played on one ever dry pitch in the Lancashire League. It was always wet,
You couldn't run at that pace.
No.
But in most of the time, though, here, you played for a long time at Derby. How did that come about?
Yeah, well, I was in Australia when there was an Ashes tour going on. I think it was somewhere around 82, 83, whatever Ashes tour was around that period. I was playing with Tasmania, I think.
Uh-huh.
And Dusty Miller, who was at Derby at the time, came to me and said that Derbyshire had asked him to approach me to play county cricket. And I said, Dusty, I don't play county cricket, because I had been approached from way back in 76 to sign for Sussex. And I told Dusty, I don't play county cricket. He said, why? I said, it's too much cricket. I'm not interested in playing that much cricket. You know, so many West Indian guys, Andy Roberts and those guys that had played county cricket, told me how strenuous it was. And apparently perhaps went back to them and said, you know, he's not interested. And they said, well, tell him we don't want him to play the entire season. We just need him to play half the number of county games and all the one-day games. So that was the approach that they took with me, and they asked me to do that. I said, well, Dusty, that sounds a little bit more reasonable. I don't mind doing that. So I signed with Derbyshire, and people say, why Derbyshire? Derbyshire, because it was Derbyshire who asked. Yeah. It's as simple as that.
And because Jeff Shaw Powell.
And Dusty and myself had a very good relationship. We played test cricket against each other. We'd go out for dinner together during the test match, which I don't think takes place these days. And we still have a very good relationship.
Did you enjoy county cricket?
Not really. To be honest, not really. But, you know, by halfway through the season at Derbyshire, we were out of everything. We didn't have a very
great team. No.
So by halfway through the season, you couldn't win anything. We got to the Benson Hedges finals 1 year. And if you're playing and you're not competing and you don't have a chance of winning anything, it's not easy.
I mean, away from Test arena, I mean, you played for Jamaica.
Yeah.
You played for Tasmania. You played for
Canterbury in New Zealand.
Once you were established in the that very high form of the game, did you enjoy these other excursions?
If I didn't enjoy it, I wouldn't have gone.
No.
Believe me. I went to Canterbury again because of friendship. John Wright, who was at Derby at the time, New Zealand were touring Australia. And he and Richard Hadley, who played for Canterbury, were going to be away. And they needed somebody to try and bolster the team. And Wright asked me if I would be interested. I said, Wright, sure, why not? So I went and played for Canterbury. I went to Tasmania because of Jack Simmons from Lancashire. Jack and Hughes. David Hughes.
Yeah.
They used to play for Tassie before Tassie got recognition, and we were playing state, recognized as a state to play in the Sheffield Shield. And when they were first asked to play in the Sheffield Shield, Jack came to me and asked me if I would go and play professional cricket, play for Tassie. And I said, sure, because Jack and myself, we still have a very good relationship. I don't like to lose friendships.
No.
And Jack was pretty much sorting out contracts for me at that time.
In the last section of the programme, we'll talk about your life since you gave up first-class cricket. Of course, we see you on the television all the time and hear you. We'll talk about horse racing things. But one thing I must ask you as well, it would be wrong, having got one of the great fast bowlers of history in front of me, I must ask you about batting. Do you like batting?
I enjoyed batting, but I didn't waste my energies batting if I didn't have to. But whenever I'm
trying to think of you. Were you one of those big fast bowlers who used to get the occasional 30 or 40 by?
I have 6 test 50s, Danny.
I like to
boast about that.
Yeah. Well, hang on. Jimmy Anderson's got one now. Anyone can get a test 50.
He won't get 5 more.
No, he won't. Yeah, of course you've got 6. But of course, let's be fair, you were often coming in when the score was 607 for 5.
No, we never got those scores. Like, in my entire career, I can only remember the West Indies team getting 600 once. We never batted that long. We weren't interested in getting that many runs.
No.
Once we got 350, we thought we were in a very good position.
Okay. So you did enjoy batting, though?
I did.
And what was your favourite innings? It doesn't have to be a big one. What was your favourite innings you remember playing?
My favourite innings, to be honest, goes way back to 1976 in Jamaica.
Right.
Playing against India. India had us in a bit of bother, and Derek Murray and myself put up good partnership together. And I remember hitting Bishen Bedi and some other guys out of the ground. And I enjoyed that innings because it put us back in a winning position, which of course we did win the test match and then won the series.
Okay. Talk to me about the petrol station years.
I started that business just about at the second Gulf War.
In Jamaica,
yes.
A petrol station or more than one?
A single petrol station. Shell petrol station.
Yeah.
Because the general manager of Shell, well, we are still very good friends. And I went to him and asked him if it was a good business to get involved in.
Sure.
He said, Mike, it's okay, but it's hard work. I said, I don't mind hard work. I want to do something.
Yeah.
So I got this petrol station. And believe me, the first 9 months of running that petrol station, I was there 18 hours a day for 9 months. I was falling asleep on going on the way home and that sort of a thing. But at the same time, it was challenging, but I enjoyed it. And I look back on that those 9 months and think to myself, yeah, you did some hard work, but at least at the end of the day, you achieved something. I had a petrol station for much longer than 9 months, of course. But by after 9 months, I could then relax a little bit, get somewhere to manage it more than I was actually spending time there, although I was still there. But the first 9 months, 18 hours a day, I was at that station.
Are you a celebrity back home in Jamaica? Or are there so many fast bowlers that...
I'm a celebrity without being a celebrity. Nobody comes up to me and asks me for an autograph in Jamaica. Everybody will shout, hey, Mikey, and you know, you put out your hand through the car and everybody knows you.
Sure.
But then no one is going to come and bother you. Nobody is going to sit at a restaurant and come to you and ask you for an autograph. They see you every day. So it's not something new that they're seeing. It's not something that they think, oh, I need to get his autograph. I might never see him again.
Right. Okay. More recently, of course, though... where we know you from, I don't know what else you do to keep the world from the door. You're a very famous cricket commentator, television, and I know you worked in the radio as well.
Yeah.
Your voice, of course, you have a very good timbre, unlike my sort of nasal whine. you got and your accent is very both easy to understand, but also very redolent of your native Caribbean.
I have to slow down, though, Danny, when I speak. When
sure.
I'm in this country, I have to slow down a lot.
Of course, and I dare say you take some of the local slang and twang out of your voice when you're at home.
Yeah.
Do you enjoy commentating? I mean,
very much.
Yeah.
I love the job that I do, and I love the people that I work with. The guys that I work with at Sky are a fantastic bunch of guys. We have a very good relationship, and I think that is felt through the microphone. You know, we have such a good relationship, and we enjoy each other's company. We give Nassau the same stick sometimes, but at the same time, we enjoy each other's company. I think we really enjoy it.
Because cricket commentary, it strikes me, and I've done some of it, cricket commentary, it's both very difficult because of the length of time involved, but it also gives you fantastic opportunities because you can go off down... I mean, let's be fair, not all cricket is exciting all the time.
Yeah.
That's not the way the game works. And you can go off down, sometimes it's nostalgia, sometimes it's a side issue, sometimes it's a political issue. There's great opportunities to express yourself in it.
Yeah, but I don't find cricket commentary difficult. You know, especially, it might be difficult on radio, because I think on radio you have to be a lot more detailed, because people can't see it. But on television, the pictures are there already. All you're supposed to be doing is adding to those pictures. So I don't really find it difficult. But when you talk about going off on side issues, as I just said, sometimes things are a little bit slow. And that is, again, great fun, to talk about things of the past or talk about certain issues within the game. Because people are seeing the pictures, they are already, you know, nothing exciting happening. So you give them a story about something else. And I enjoy that aspect of it as well. And depending on who you're on with at the time, it even makes it more fun.
And you talk about how, as a player on the pitch, you were a very emotional guy, and we've heard about various outbursts and things like that. I don't think you're quite as hidden as you think you are on the television either. I remember when Mohammed Amir, bless him, teenager,
was
sent to prison for fixing the, you know, for spot fixing.
Yeah.
You must know the interview I'm talking about, where you could hardly speak. You were so emotional. I thought you were going to cry.
Not really, but I felt very, very bad for the young man, because I understood the circumstances under which things took place, and I can imagine myself being that young and getting into a team and being influenced by people senior to me and people that I look up to, and them coming to me and telling me to do certain things. So I felt very, very sorry for him. And, you know, to see that sort of talent being wasted. Danny, you don't get that sort of talent every day. And to see it being wasted that way, I felt very sad for him.
Along with your time as a commentator, you've also been involved with the ICC. And I noticed, of course, your Sky colleagues, before, during and after your time as an official in the game, forever talking to you about plans. And they were like using you as a conduit into the world cricket authorities. Enjoy is not the right word. Did you achieve anything when you were being an official?
I think so. I think I was a part of the cricket committee. I was a part of the first ever committee that looked into throwing officially, because of people are always looking into throwing. And I remember being in the first ever meeting to discuss particular bowlers and their actions. And Imran Khan was on that committee at the time. And we had a lot of guys who were big names in the game in that committee. And I enjoyed that aspect of it. And I enjoyed some of the things that we put forward to the ICC and the executive committee and that sort of thing. So I can't say I look back on that and regret it. There are certain things that I regret about it, yes, but I enjoyed being there.
The other love of your life, I think, is horse racing, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
You actually
very
live in
so.
Newmarket, don't
yes,
you?
Yes, yes.
People tell me, because at least one of my colleagues here at TalkSport, of course, is a minor trainer at Newmarket, that you ought to be seen on the gallops early in the morning sometime.
Every morning,
with
if
your
I'm
binoculars,
not working.
Yeah?
I was there this morning before I came to London.
What's the attraction?
I just love horses. I've always loved horses.
First of all, I should make a point. Jamaicans, they love horse racing. That's a cliche, but it's also true, isn't it?
Well,
Caymanas Park and
Caymanas
all that.
Park. Yeah. Well, Jamaica, of all the Caribbean islands, Jamaica has the most horse racing.
Yeah, they love it.
They have 100 odd meetings every year. One track, but it's dirt. It's not turf like here that can get chewed up and that sort of thing. So they have a lot of racing. I used to own horses in Jamaica. But my love for horses started from when I was a kid, because my brother, who is older, 5 years older than I am, his godmother owned the horses. So whenever he went to the racetrack or went to the stables, I went with him. So that's where my fascination with horses started. But then I got the opportunity to meet Michael Stout in 1985. And we have become very good friends. And I pretty much live in his back pocket these days. Every day when I'm not working on a cricket match, I'm on the at the stables or on the heath with him.
Have you ever ridden a horse?
Not a racehorse. I sat on Cribensis. I don't know how many people remember that horse, Cribensis, who Michael Stout trained as a flat horse, who then did hurdles and won the champion hurdle.
Mm-hmm.
I sat on Cribensis. And as a matter of fact, I think it's my first book or perhaps my second book. I think it's my first book. There's a picture of me sitting on Cribensis in that book.
And what I say, apart from the fascination, what do you get? I mean, are you a gambling man?
That's not my primary purpose.
You just love the animals and the racing.
I love racing, and I love the early mornings. When I was a kid, my mother used to tell me, you have to get up early to study. Never did. I get up early every morning. This morning, they pulled out at 5:45. I was there at 5:40.
How many other people are there, Michael? Is there a lot of people, or a handful, or just you?
You have some people on the gallops, yes. You have the people there working, because they are work watchers.
Yeah.
They work for the racing post or work for other racing organizations. Mm-hmm. But I am constant at Michael Stout's yard. You'll have managers for horses. You'll have owners, a few owners that will come every now and again. And managers for stud farms that will come different times. But I am constant. I am there every day. And he expects me to be there.
That's it for this edition of My Sporting Life with Michael Holding. My genuine thanks to Michael for coming in and being such great company over the last 2 hours. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have doing it, because if you have, you've had a ball.
So big thanks to both Danny Kelly and Michael Holding for the last 90 minutes or so. Don't forget, we'll be releasing weekly episodes of the My Sporting Life series with big names such as Matthew Hayden, Sir Kirtley Ambrose and Sir Andrew Strauss all to come. As well as this, the Cricket Collective returns next week. Neil Manthorpe and Steve Harmison looking back at the Bob Willis Trophy final, and hearing from both Joe Root and Joss Butler, as well as Tamar Mills, as the England team fly out to Dubai via Oman for the T20 World Cup. So keep an eye out for that. But that's about it for this show. Thanks for listening to Following On.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.